this covetous person, shall be no more called liberal. And what this is really saying is that during that time, the truth is going to prevail, and there's not going to be a whitewashing or a flattery given to somebody who doesn't deserve it. If he's covetous, he'll not be called liberal. If he's covetous, he's going to be called covetous. And the churl, nor the churl, said to be bountiful. If this churl, who is a miserly person, who is an ill-bred, rude, surly person, if he's truly that, he's not going to be called bountiful. Now, during the reign, no doubt, of Ahaz, or during the reign of false doctrine, certainly the truth is not always held to. And so a covetous man, just to so that he doesn't do you some harm, may be called bountiful, or he may be called liberal. But he said during that time, the churl will not be called bountiful, and neither will the covetous man or the vile man be called liberal. Excuse me. Think of this teaching in verse 5. Well, let's go ahead and get verse 6, then we'll make a conclusion. For the vile person will speak villainy or folly, and his heart will work iniquity to practice hypocrisy and to utter error against the Lord, to make empty the soul of the hungry, and he will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. That is, this person who's covetous, he's not going to be championing the cause of the Lord, but he's going to be doing things and teaching a doctrine and practicing hypocrisy that'll make empty the soul of the hungry, and he will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. And the thought that came to me here was, the person who maybe is simply teaching for money, for filthy lucre, who's just in it to see what kind of living he can make for himself, and he is not going to teach the kind of a doctrine that'll fill the hungry soul, but he's going to make empty the soul of the hungry, and he'll not cause the drink, or will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail, because he'll not be giving them truly the water of life. He'll have other ulterior motives behind his teaching, maybe obvious or maybe not so obvious. He'll be under pressures, he'll be under certain kind of strain, so that his teaching will actually be what is called folly here. Now in verse 7, the instruments also of the churl are evil. He deviseth wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words, even when the needy speaketh right. Now this churl, who is another word for covetousness, or rude, or surly, or ill-bred person, he has what is called here instruments that are evil. The instruments of the churl are evil. And the first thing that came to my mind as I read this and tried to make an application of it was the apostate church. The church that fell away and was certainly an unfaithful church and is still even today an unfaithful church, the Catholic Church. This is an institution that has instruments that are evil. He says he deviseth wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words, even when the needy speaketh right. He has instruments that are designed to destroy the poor with lying words. The poor, of course, are those that would be righteous, those that are not ungodly, those that are not using these ungodly means. But how are they destroyed? They're destroyed with lying words, even when the needy speaketh right. Well, it's not hard for us to see how that there was a time, and may even still yet be a time, in which those who speak the truth are destroyed because of the truth. There was a time of the Inquisition. There was a time when it was against the law for you to own a Bible or to interpret a Bible or to practice anything that the clergy didn't tell you how to practice. They were destroyed with lies. And even whenever they spoke what was right, they were destroyed. And so we read in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9, a very fitting description of this apostate church. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. He's talking about the Catholic Church here in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9. And he says that his coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish because they receive not the love of the truth that they might be saved. So they had lying wonders. They were really teaching a lie. And so those that would try to teach the truth, they were completely overwhelmed. They were drowned out by the lie. And so truly the poor were destroyed with lying words. Well, in that kingdom age, even though this situation might exist, the churl was not said to be bountiful, and the vile person was not called liberal. That is, the church always has called a churl, and a vile person, a false teacher, a propounder of lies, a covetous person. The church has called them what they are. It does not flatter these people. It does not give them titles and privileges and positions that they're not entitled to. So in verse 8, but the liberal deviseth liberal things, and by liberal things shall he stand. And the word liberal here means to be free, or to be willing, or to be noble. And certainly those who are teaching the truth, they're truly the ones who are known as liberal. They're the ones who are noble or free or willing. They're willing to do what's right. They're free from the ties of covetousness. And they are the ones that are noble in the sight of God. So he divides liberal things. That is, things that are going to assist people. We teach nothing, we practice nothing that are not a benefit to all mankind. Not a thing do we teach that's to anybody's detriment, that's going to do any harm or hurt or destruction to anybody. And this truly is right in harmony with the definition of love. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor, which means we'll do nothing that's going to hurt anybody. Our teaching will be that which is described here as liberal things. And by liberal things shall he stand. That's the way we stand. We do not have to be deceitful. We do not have to lie. We do not have to leave the truth in order to stand. We stand on what we know is right. Now, this may be a stretching of this prophecy, of this passage. But to me, that seems to be one of the fuller applications of it. Now, as we said in the first verse, certainly this applies to Hezekiah. There's no way that we want to say that it doesn't apply to Hezekiah in the lesser fulfillment. But in the greater fulfillment, it can only apply to the time of the Messiah, which time we're now living in. Beginning in verse 9, he takes a little different turn now of this prophecy. And he tells them about a great calamity that's going to come upon them. The Bible scholars are divided as to when this time is he's speaking of here, beginning in verse 9. Some think that it is the Assyrian invasion. Some think that it's the Chaldean or Babylonian invasion. I prefer to think it's the Babylonian invasion because we've already talked about the Assyrian invasion, and it would have to be going back in time to re-speak of something that's already been spoken of and already happened. So I prefer to think that this is the Babylonian invasion, which came some 150 years later, of course, that he warns them about repeatedly, and its consequences and the blessings that followed it. So he begins in verse 9 by saying, rise up, ye women that are at ease. Hear my voice, ye careless daughters. Give ear unto my speech. Now, ye women that are at ease. He's talking about here, of course, the women who were more affluent, who no doubt had plenty. They had gorgeous apparel to wear. They didn't have to worry about the cares of the city or of the kingdom or of God's people. And so he turns to them now with this part of the prophecy. Rise up, ye women that are at ease. You know, in Amos we have a statement that says, woe unto them that are at ease in Zion. Now there's such a thing as just not paying any attention to what's going on around about you. Not being concerned about the great calamities of the times, certainly the spiritual calamities, The church can be just falling down into shambles. Members can be apostatizing right and left. They can be leading lives that are contrary to what the doctrine is. And those who teach may not be teaching the Bible. And some people couldn't care less. They're still at ease in Zion. And that's the way it was with these women. They're at ease. Ye careless daughters, they felt no alarm. But I want you to know there are times in which we are to not be at ease. There are times in which we are to feel some alarm and we're to be careful and we're to be concerned. He says to them, give ear unto my speech. Many days and years shall ye be troubled, ye careless women. Well, we don't know how long this time was. Many days and years. That's a very difficult time to determine how long it was. If it was the invasion of the Babylonians, it was some 150 years from now. If it was the invasion of the Assyrians, well, he's gone back into time. We don't know how far back he's gone before he comes back up to this time of the Assyrian invasion. But I still prefer to think it's the Babylonian invasion. So many days and years you shall be troubled, ye careless women, for the vintage shall fail and the gathering shall not come. That is, your troubles are going to be of such a nature that the vintage is going to fail. One of the chief crops of this area was wine. It was the product of the grape. And it's going to fail, he says, and the gathering shall not come. You're not going to have a harvest. Either because of war or because of the strife and turmoil that go as a result of war. Some reason they're not going to have the vintage or the gathering. Tremble, ye women that are at ease. Be troubled, ye careless ones. Here again, he's telling them to take some concern, some thought about what's going to happen. Strip you and make you bare and gird sackcloth upon your loins. That is, take off your high and mighty fashionable clothing. Strip yourself, make yourself bare, and then put on sackcloth. It's a time of mourning. It's a time to be most concerned. Then he says in verse 12, and this is a verse that some have a most difficult time making an application of, they shall lament for the teats, for the pleasant fields, and for the fruitful vine. And the word teats here means breasts. And there are all kinds of descriptions given as to what this means. But when you look at the context, you realize that pleasant fields are a source of nourishment and of sustaining life. The fruitful vine was also a source of nourishment and life and sustaining themselves. And so the breasts were a source of nourishment and of sustaining life among the babes. And it's just put in here in the category with the fruitful fields and the fruitful vine, or the pleasant fields and fruitful vine, showing that there'd be a time when there would be lack of the necessities. They would not have enough. They'd mourn, they'd lament over this lack of the things that they had need of. Upon the land of my people shall come up thorns and briars, yea, upon all the houses of joy in the joyous city. Now there's a similar description given to this area in chapter 7, verses 20 through 25, talking about an invasion upon the area of Jerusalem. We're not going to turn and read that. But he's just simply saying here that his people shall have thorns and briars come up on their land. It'll not be a fruitful place. It'll not be a land of plenty. It'll not be a place even desirable to be in. And upon all the houses of joy in the joyous city. And of course, the joyous city would really, to me, I think of Jerusalem. Because the palaces shall be forsaken. Now the word palaces here could apply to the temple, but it could also apply to the places where the rulers lived. The multitude of the city shall be left. The forts and towers shall be for dens forever, a joy of wild asses and a pasture of flocks. Well, the forts or hills are prominent cliffs, and the towers were towers that were built on the wall of the city. All these are going to be left and deserted, and they'll lose their original function. They'll be destroyed. They'll no longer stand. You're going to have a city that's going to be desolation. It's going to be a place that'll be for dens, and the word for dens means bandits. It's going to be a place where bandits will come and hide and live, and it'll be a joy of wild asses. That is, wild animals will come there, and it'll be a joy to them because there won't be any people to bother them. It's going to be a desolate place and a pasture of flocks. And this verse 14 to me certainly is a very apt description of the city of Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity. They were taken away. There was no more ruler. There was no more need for a palace. The towers on the wall, the very temple itself was destroyed and profaned and no longer existed or functioned. And so wild beasts and flocks and bandits roved where there used to be civilization. And then he says in verse 15, until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high. This situation was going to last until the Spirit of God was poured upon us from on high. Here's another prophecy now that has a lesser and a greater fulfillment. The lesser fulfillment, of course, was the coming back of the people from the Babylonian captivity. That was the lesser fulfillment. That was again when God had prophets. That was when they rebuilt the temple. The service of the temple was reestablished. But the greater fulfillment of this was, of course, whenever the Messiah came and established the church. In the second chapter of Acts, we have a description of the Spirit there as it filled these apostles on the day of Pentecost. And they were filled with this Spirit as of a mighty wind, and they spake in tongues of other languages so that all the people there could understand what they said. We read of some 17 nationalities. And here again we have a greater fulfillment of the prophecy. So the Spirit be poured upon us from on high, and the wilderness be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted for a forest. Now there's going to be a reversing of things here. The wilderness would be a fruitful field. Well, in the time of the coming back from the captivity, the city of Jerusalem in its desolate state was the wilderness. It was a place where the wild animals stayed and the bandits. But he said it's going to become a fruitful field. And the fruitful field, which was no doubt the area of Babylon, that's where the great civilization was, shall be counted for a forest. That is, it'll become desolate. It'll not have civilization. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. The judgment of God is going to come upon this wilderness. That'd be Babylon. Babylon had to suffer the judgments of God, and righteousness shall remain in the fruitful field. That is, at the city of Jerusalem where God's people were. Now, as we look at the greater fulfillment of this prophecy, the wilderness there becoming a fruitful field, that would be the Gentiles. We're the Gentiles who were a wilderness. We were the wild olive tree, unfruitful to God, vessels of wrath fitted for destruction, without a citizenship, without a nation, aliens from God, foreigners and strangers. He said the wilderness will become a fruitful field. And of course, that was wilderness, those Gentiles did become a fruitful field. And the fruitful field, which was the Jewish nation, the people who rejected the head stone of the corner, the fruitful field shall be counted for a forest. Then shall judgment be in the wilderness. That'd be those Jews who were supposed to have been in the church, but who stumbled and who didn't obey the gospel. They then felt and are still feeling the judgment of God. And righteousness remain in the fruitful field, which of course is now the church, the Gentiles. Righteousness remain in the fruitful field. Anything that can get into the fruitful field and be a part of it, and it still be a fruitful field, will have righteousness. You know, in chapter 29, verse 17, he alludes to the very same thing. He says, is it not yet a very little while, and Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field shall be esteemed as a forest? Lebanon was always noted for being a forest, not a fruitful field. And the area around Palestine and Carmel was a fruitful field. He said, yet a little while and Lebanon's going to be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field is going to be like a forest. There's going to be some changes in God's people. And certainly those changes have taken place in the lesser sense and in the greater sense. And I want you to know that they can happen even yet again in another sense, because there's a time coming in which all Israel shall be saved when the fullness of the Gentiles is coming in, according to Romans 11. And so there's a time coming, according to that, in which the Jewish people are going to receive the truth. That time hasn't come yet. But it certainly seems to be clearly prophesied in Romans 11th chapter. And the work of righteousness. And this word work really means effect. What's going to be the results of all of this? What's going to be the effect of all of this? And the work of righteousness shall be peace. That's going to be the result of it. Certainly Israel had peace for a temporary time. But the church also is the great institution of peace. Peace comes only from God the Father and our Lord Jesus Christ. And we in the church are the only persons who can have this peace, because we're the only ones who are turning to God to receive it from its only source. And so that's the work or the effect of righteousness shall be peace. Now we're talking about, when we say peace, we're talking about that feeling of inner tranquility in which we know that everything is all right in the spiritual realm. We know that everything is all right between us and our God because we are following fully His commands and desires. We're working and maintaining a peaceful atmosphere for our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. And we're doing all within our power to be at peace with all men everywhere. That's a peace that the world does not know nor understand. And the effect of righteousness, quietness, and assurance forever. That's the effect that righteousness is going to have. The work of righteousness is going to be peace, quietness, and assurance forever. That did not happen, of course, before the time of the Messiah. Only during the age of the Messiah, which is the church age, which we now live in today, only during that time have we been in a position to say that the effect is peace and quietness and assurance forever. And my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation. And truly the church, the true church, is a peaceable habitation. There may be wars and tumults and fightings and conflicts and temptations outside of the church and all around us. But in the church, it's a peaceable habitation. If we're in a church where there's not peace, we better stop and take some serious thought as to whether or not we're the church. Something bad, wrong is happening. Because in the church there's to be peace. My people, he says, shall dwell in a peaceable habitation. And in sure dwellings, and in a quiet resting place, or in quiet resting places. We're going to be secure. We're going to be safe. And as Hebrews says in the 12th chapter, wherefore we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken, or which cannot fall. Our kingdom cannot be shaken. Everything else will be shaken, but the only thing that will remain is this kingdom which we've received. It's the one thing that will not be shaken. And so here he says, sure dwellings, and quiet resting places. Oh, that's the desire of all mankind. But only those in the church have found this spiritual home that truly is described in this verse. So he says in verse 19, when it shall hail, coming down on the forest, and the city shall be low in a low place. Now there's going to be a time when it's going to hail, and there's going to be devastation, there's going to be destruction. The city's in a low place. It's going to be destroyed. But people of God are going to be in this safe, secure place. Now this city, the city shall be low in a low place, has been thought by many to be different cities. Some say that it's the city of Nineveh, talking about the city of the Assyrians. Others say, no, it's the city of the Babylonians, the city of Babylonia itself. Others say, no, it's the city of Jerusalem. And the city of Jerusalem, of course, could be when that city was destroyed in AD 70 by the Roman army. And there again, it was obliterated. The temple was destroyed. And no longer has it been the worship of God in the temple since that time. And that truly each one could have been lesser and greater fulfillments of this prophecy. But as I think in my own mind, the city that comes to my mind here that's in the low, low place is the apostate church, the Catholic church. It's described as the city of Babylon. It's Babylon and her destruction we read about in Revelation. And so it, as it's destroyed and as it undergoes the turmoil of life, we in the church are in a safe, secure position. Blessed are ye that sow beside all waters, that send forth thither the feet of the ox and the ass. Now this little verse here is probably a description of their sowing of rice and certain grains of the day. The word besides really is translated in. So blessed are ye that sow in all waters. And the custom was to take the seed or the rice and even the wheat in some cases and cast it on this water, and then they would tread this fertile soil that was being flooded over by the river. They would tread it out with their oxen or their ass, and as these animals would walk on it, they would prepare the land and put the seed out into the land. And so that's what he's saying here. Blessed are ye that sow beside or in all waters, that send forth thither the feet of the ox and the ass. In Ecclesiastes 11 and 1, we have an allusion made to this very thing, in which he says in Ecclesiastes 11 and 1, cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. In that passage, he's talking about them being liberal and giving as they should, and that's casting your bread upon the waters. That is, you're casting the seed, which is the bread, cast the seed upon the waters, and then it's going to come back, you'll find it, it's going to come back and reproduce itself multifold, and so when you give to others and are assisting others in their need, you're only sowing seed that'll grow to you bountifully fruit yet in the future. And that's what he says in Ecclesiastes, and it's a similar description to this in our last verse of chapter 32. Blessed are ye that sow besides all waters, and send forth thither the feet of the ox and the ass. That is, you're gonna bring forth fruit. The sowing that you do, this giving of the things that God wants you to give, that you do, when it's put in the right place and done as it should, is going to be a blessed act, and you're going to receive, as a result of it, blessing. Well, we're going to close at that verse and at the end of that chapter, since our time is about out anyway. Does anybody have any comments or any questions that they'd like to give on the passages that we discussed tonight? Three through six. 2 Kings 18, 3 through 6. That's a description of Hezekiah's kingship. It may seem on the surface that we have strained or stretched some of these statements made in this chapter tonight. But the more we study it, and the more we try to see how it is to be applied and how it could have possibly been fulfilled, well, we see that it wasn't fulfilled under the time of Moses. It wasn't fulfilled before the time of the Messiah. And they so fittingly do apply, so we have lesser and greater fulfillments. And next time, Lord willing, we'll begin with the 33rd chapter of Isaiah. If it's... see, which verse was that? Oh, the 14th verse. That means that this city, this area that was so fully civilized and habitable, would become so desolate that it would be a pasture land. Wouldn't be people living there, but it'd be flocks living there. Just like downtown Hamilton today, you don't see flocks grazing on the square. But if it became a desolate city and nobody lived there, it'd be a pasture land. And a joy of wild asses. The wild animals felt comfortable there. It was a joyous place for them because there weren't any people around to bother them.
Well, that commentary a while ago described it more or less as a desert. And I couldn't picture flocks being in a desert.
Well, desert doesn't always mean no foliage. Desert can be thick foliage. Desert can be like a forest even, but it's deserted by civilization and people. It doesn't always mean that there's no foliage there. It doesn't always mean that there's no plants. But it can be a place that's so thick with thickets that you couldn't even walk through it. But that could be described in the Bible as a desert. Like the desert of, or the wilderness of Judea that John the Baptist was in. He ate locusts and wild honey and all. That's a thickly, densely